So just sit comfortably once again. Okay, I'm sitting in the meditation posture. I'm just going to talk now. So yes, welcome to those, particularly those of you who haven't been to the Ramble before. It was a bit of an experiment of having Ramble at this time. One of the things I quite like about this format is that it's informal and it's outside of the program. So it's not part of the established program, and in a way, I was quite happy. I don't know whether I was quite happy, but I'd like to think I was quite happy just to ramble to an empty room. sure, I wouldn't be, really, but anyway. I think there's something valuable about it being outside of the program. So we're not doing it as part of a program of events, but just because there's something valuable to explore, and do it for a good reason, in a way. So what we've been exploring for these last 2 nights is 5 great stages of the path. We've been exploring them as both stages and aspects. So as stages, the spiritual path begins with integration. It begins with becoming a whole person, rather than a collection of cells vying for supremacy. Hi there, come on. So it begins with, spiritual path begins with collecting ourselves so that we really can act for our own benefit and purpose. And part of this first stage of spiritual life that I was emphasizing yesterday is we need to get to know ourselves. We need to get to know the kind of being we are, the kind of mental physique we have. Whether we're an extrovert or an introvert, our basic kind of character traits, what do we need to work well, to function happily. And this is an ongoing process, isn't it? But we need to do that. It's a very important part of spiritual life, is sort of discovering who you are, divining who you are, finding out by observing yourself and observing your life what helps you work effectively and what actually stops you working effectively as a creature, as it were. And we all need very particular environments. What environments do you flourish in? What environments actually clearly bring out the worst in you, or at least are not the best in you? Yeah. So part of the stage of integration is a really clear looking at yourself to find out the kind of person you are so that you can take that into account in the next stage of the spiritual life. So we need to be integrated, we need to be aware of ourselves, we need to be especially basing our awareness in our physical self, in our physical senses, so that as the self develops in spiritual life, we develop in a balanced, integrated way. We don't have parts of ourselves rushing too far forward and parts of ourselves left too much in the shadow. I think it's also rather interesting to look at who you don't like, especially who you don't like, the type you find yourself not liking. Sometimes I think that there always has to be an it, someone that I don't like or don't get on with. And then that person seems to be similar to the other person that was person I didn't get on with. So sometimes there's a value in looking at who you find difficult and what is it about them that you find difficult, and is that saying something about yourself? I mean, it's a cliche now, isn't it, but some of the aspects of ourselves that we don't want to own, we throw onto other people. Sometimes I think it's things that they do more overtly than us, if you mean. And you can't bear that in them because you can't bear that in yourself. So all these are to do with collecting a real objective sense of yourself, as far as you can do that. Of course, as I was saying yesterday, that's a sort of bit infinite, really. You can never quite finish doing that. But that needs to be both a stage and an aspect of spiritual life all the time. And we need to consciously and continuously be bringing on ourselves back to body awareness. We need to be rooting our life mind, our spiritual life, in direct experience rather than in the secondary constructions of our mind. Otherwise we'll move forward with too much of a bright idea and not enough real experience of who we are.
Yeah.
So we'll evolve in an unbalanced way, and we'll have to, well, that will cause problems later on, and we'll have to correct those later on, and they're more difficult to correct later on. Also, if we don't know ourselves very well, we'll do things that cause problems for ourselves later on. Things that look good, that look like the right thing to do, but because we don't know ourselves enough, actually aren't very useful for us. It's all those sorts of things that you can put under this title of integration. Then the second stage of spiritual life, or the second aspect of spiritual life, is positive emotion, or what I was saying like yesterday, kusala karma, which means skillful action. So on the basis of knowing yourself, on the basis of understanding what makes you tick, what helps yourself flourish, and what helps yourself, rot, what helps yourself not do very well, on that basis you can then make conscious, intentional choices about how to act more and more for the benefit of yourself and other people, because it's based in real self-awareness, based in body awareness. So you can make real ethical choices. So the second stage is the stage of ethics. The 10 precepts if you're ordained, the 5 precepts if you're not ordained. Really, the 10 precepts are simply an elaboration of the 5 precepts. So it's the whole ethical life, which is really trying to do as much good and as least harm as possible. But to be able to do that, you need to know yourself well, and you need to know other people well. And the more we act ethically, the more our experience comes back to us in a refined, aesthetic, deepened and more satisfying way. Sometimes all you need to do is be generous to someone and you already feel in a better state, even if you weren't in a good state before. Generosity is one of those things that doesn't require a positive state of mind behind it. You can just do it. You can make someone concede, you can just buy somebody something, you can just be generous. You can give someone your time. And then what we do in the second stage, we develop through ethics. And spiritual life is primarily a life of ethics. What we're doing in meditation, for instance, is primarily ethical. The Buddhist vision of meditation is that most of the work of meditation is done outside of meditation. Practice of mindfulness, the practice of loving kindness. Most of all that has been done outside of meditation. All you need to do in the actual meditation itself is just sort of settle down a bit and just sharpen your focus a bit, and there you are. Is that your experience? there you are, you know. But that is the Buddhist vision, that most of the work of practice is outside of practice, and then all you need to do in the meditation itself is relax a bit, sort of fine-tune your concentration, and you're in dhyana. Most of what we're doing in spiritual life is really an ethical matter. Anything that undermines ethics undermines the Dharma and undermines Buddhism. Buddhism is largely an ethical vision. Somebody a while ago went to interview Bhante, and one of the first questions was, how do you know if you made spiritual progress? And Bhante just said, you'll be a little less selfish. What about, what about third eye opening? What about levitating? What about... no, you'll be a little less selfish. That is very, very good. He's very down to earth and straightforward. Yeah? So, if you want to know if you've made spiritual progress, you need to ask yourself, am I a little less selfish than I was? Can I be with people more comfortably than I did? Am I more at ease with other people? And on the opposite, am I more at ease in my own company? Am I a little less selfish? Am I a little less self-preoccupied? And all that is ethical life. The word ethics, not great really. There's never really a word for this. The word is sila, which means ethics. But you could say helpful actions, but even that's a bit soft sounding. It's the whole world of generating the good and renouncing the harmful. And yesterday I included particularly in this not only the practice of ethics based on self-awareness, but also the development of friendship. Friendship is a very important part of this stage, a vital part of spiritual life. And every Buddhist centre that you go to, there should be this atmosphere of friendship. Interesting, I've been noticing some of my friends. You'll find I do a lot of aside, that is. That's the value of a ramble, I can just ramble. but I've been noticing a lot of my friends, well, not a lot, actually two. That's ethics, you see? I tend to do that anyway, yeah. I've been noticing two of my friends, actually one. I've noticed two of my friends who have started to say to me something like, you know, they've been exploring other Buddhist groups or even other spiritual traditions, and they've been saying, actually, what I'm really missing is the Sangha, what the Sri Ratna Buddhist movement has got, is the Sangha. And I don't find that in Dzogchen, surprise, surprise, and I don't find that in some other Buddhist religious traditions. And what slightly alarms me is that sometimes it's almost as if, well, you go somewhere and get teachings, but here you get nice people. So can I do nice people here? I don't actually want to be a nice person, to be honest. But anyway, that aside, can I come here for Sangha, but I go elsewhere for them? But actually, the reason why Sangha is such a clearly important, is because of our Dharma, is because of the Buddha's teaching, is because of Sangharakshita's revisioning of the Buddha's teaching. Every spiritual movement has its own Dharma. The fact that we have this Sangha, and we put so much emphasis on that, the fact that somebody today brings Toblerone and breaks it into a bowl, is because of our Dharma. It's because of what we teach, what we value. Yeah? Somebody not doing that is also because of their Dharma, if you mean their teaching. So there's no Sangha without Dharma. The Sangha, if there is a Sangha, arises out of a particular vision of spiritual life. So friendship is, and friendliness, and community, recruitedness, our emphasis on teams, all those sorts of things, are expressions of our Dharma, are expressions of our vision of reality itself. So not only friendship and so forth, especially friendship, I was emphasising yesterday the enjoyment of art and the enjoyment of nature. I won't say much more about that today because I'll just reiterate everything I've said, but you can listen to me on that, which I presume will become eventually a web on the web, if you want to. But as I said yesterday, that what ethics does, what all of that does, what friendship does, what exploring, experiencing nature does, what experiencing the art in the genuine sense, not in a sort of snobbish sense, but in the genuine sense does, is it makes self light. It makes self more and more transparent, more and more flexible, more and more ductible, changeable, receptive, malleable. Interestingly, these are the things that the Buddha said what meditation is trying to do. In the Buddha's vision, he said this is what meditation is trying to do. It's trying to make the human mind more flexible, more malleable, more receptive, more pliable, so that the nature of reality can be imprinted upon it, if you see what I mean. Without this flexible, pliable, ductable mind, we can't let reality in, because what the mind is just a sort of like a rubber ball that reality tries to poke in, and it just bounces back to its usual shape. And this is so often how we experience ourselves, don't we? We kind of me all the time, and like a force field almost, or like this rubbery ball that nothing can break into. And you vaguely even feel that, and want things to break into it, want the beauty of nature to break into it, or you want to feel more deeply for other people, but you're just sort of stuck in this rubber ball of self. So genuine ethical practice, genuine spiritual practice, in any way in which you do it, needs to be making you less selfish, less egoistic. That's the whole point. There's no other point. What makes something a spiritual practice is simply the degree to which it takes you beyond self and beyond self-clinging. no other part is to be found, if you see what I mean. All the rest of things, like some of them exotic or whatever, they may or may not help, but if they don't help that great task, then they're not really spiritual, whether they even look spiritual in the box or not.
Yeah.
And those things that aren't included in traditional Buddhism that has come down to us from ancient India, but that nevertheless do seem to genuinely lighten self, genuinely take us beyond suffering, well, they can be included in our Dharma. We just need to be very, very clear about that. But the problem is that, as I said yesterday, you end up with a refined self, a more malleable self, a more flexible self, but you've still got this self. However much you refine it, however much you develop it, there's a sort of inbuilt problem that you're using yourself to develop, that is still the self. And self is a construction. It's not something that really exists. It's something we've constructed. It's Bhatti says somewhere it's an epistemological error. It's not an ontological fact. It doesn't exist. It's an epistemological error. In other words, it's an error of knowing. It's a misreading of your perception. It's a misreading of my perception. It's the very deepest instinct we have to separate the world into self and world, you and I, and to make a self out of that and then try and defend it, and make a world out of that, and whatever we do with that world, try and grab hold of the bits we like and push away the bits we don't like. The Buddha's saying, that's just an error. You've misread the nature of your actual direct experience. You know, it's not, there's nothing any spooky about it. It's nothing spooky about it. It's just that you've misread it, and you've imputed a self, and then you've imputed a world. You've forgotten that you've done that, as it were, mythologically speaking, and you've acted as if those things really exist, and that's got you into all kinds of trouble. So what we're doing is we're working on the basis of a delusion, even in practicing spiritual life. So even in something like the Metta Bhavana, so the Metta Bhavana practice is the epitome of the second great stage of spiritual life, the stage of positive emotion. But it's still, you know, developing itself. Love for yourself and others. It's still predicated on a really existent self and a really existent other, which is fine and practically extremely useful and mustn't be dropped prematurely, because usually it's just dropped intellectually, which is really silly when people do that. They just do clever word games about how they don't like to use pronouns. It's just silliness, you know. It's just an intellectual game to make you look spiritual. Which is very unspiritual. But you see the problem. So we need, as I said yesterday, we need to die, the self needs to die. And we need to move to the stage of spiritual death. That really marks a point where you ask for ordination. When you ask for ordination into a Trīrātna Buddhist order, you're actually saying, I'm going to commit myself to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. That's really what you're saying, that okay, I've been trying to integrate myself, let's admit it folks, we've got plenty of way to go on that one. If you don't believe me, follow me home. then the stage of positive emotion, kusala karma, skillful action, plenty of way to go on that. But actually I've gained enough from those two stages to feel more and more clear that the spiritual life, the quest for how things really are, is the very meaning of life. It's the only thing finally worth doing. I don't know about you, but I'm struck by how quickly time goes. Time gets quicker as we get older. On that basis, that time is getting quicker and that we're getting older every second, you feel, actually what I need to do is commit myself to the deepest possible values, commit myself to the truth, commit myself to seeing through self-delusion, because that's the only way that I'm finally going to find peace. That's the only way that I'm going to solve the problem of myself. So asking for ordination, when you ask, is saying, okay, I want to commit myself to spiritual death. I want to actually actively let go of self. So that means that we're cultivating a real capacity to confess our shortcomings and to be quite objective about that, to be able to say, I was wrong, I have acted badly there, please forgive me. Also, obviously, the capacity to rejoice in your own merits, but particularly other people's merits. It means being able to apologise. It means being able to not always be in the lead, but being able to support if necessary. So that you don't have to be a leading person all the time. It means being willing to inconvenience yourself for the welfare of others. So that you think, actually, I don't fancy going off and leading that class tonight, but I will do it. I will put myself out for the spiritual welfare of others. In a way, that's what taking up responsibility really means, is that you're willing to personally inconvenience yourself for the spiritual welfare of other people. And that requires a kind of death. Instead of me staying at home tonight and watching Mad Men, which actually I've already watched the fourth series and the fifth series, I haven't started yet. Anyway, you know, I have to let the things I'd like to do go to come and do this. You have to do that as well, but it's slightly different when you're doing it at this level, because you know, it's much more about you giving, much more overtly. And then eventually you're trying to quite consciously see through self. You're trying to, when you get ordained, you do what's called the sixth element practice, which is about trying to really rigorously look at your experience and try to find where self is to be found, and trying to see through that. In your conflicts with people, you're trying to let go of self. Yes, not just be railroaded, but you're trying to quite consciously see, okay, is there truth in this Christian that's being made of me, even if it's an unfair one, and so on. You're trying to give other people the victory. There's a, you know, in so many ways, that's what you're committing yourself to. And as we die, the more we die, then so alongside with that, we need to be cultivating spiritual rebirth, and that's what I mainly wanted to talk about tonight. So, if there was just spiritual death, Buddhism would look like a nihilism. But what you've got is you've got this development of self. You make self light, you make self lit almost, and then you go and jump off you sort of like spiritual suicide. You just try, you don't jump, throw yourself away. It looks very nihilistic. So, alongside cultivating spiritual death, we need to cultivate spiritual rebirth. Spiritual rebirth is the most difficult thing to talk about, because that's why I've left it to be in. It's very, very difficult to talk about. But it starts with the Buddha. It starts with the Buddha here on the shrine. It starts with the historical Buddha. But alongside your quest for truth, alongside your desire to integrate yourself, to know yourself, alongside your desire to actively and consciously, intentionally cultivate ethical action on the basis of self-knowledge, is an active and intentional cultivation of devotion, an active and cultivate, an, you know, intentional cultivation of adoring, even of reverence, of love for something that you don't know what it is, an understanding that our capacity to reason has got very, very definite limits, and that there are things beyond it. There are mysteries beyond our capacity to reason. We shouldn't ditch reason, we should use reason as well as we can, but we should know its limitations. It's interesting, I've been struck by this. I was reading a while ago a book I very much recommend called Confessions of a Philosopher by Brian McGee, which for me is my introduction to philosophy. And really, it's about his philosophical life, but it's also the great philosophers that he's studied, especially Kant and Schopenhauer. He's brilliant at showing you what these philosophers were trying to get at. So he says, well, here's here's what Kant is trying to say. Firstly, there's this, and then because of that, there must be this. So, because if there must be this, then that can't fit with that. And so on. It's brilliantly done. So that I actually found it actually thrilling. And you read it and think, oh, crumb. It cannot be like life, this room, me, you know, the cushions that I'm sitting on, cannot be like what I assume them to be. If you think it through, as the great philosophers like Kant and Schopenhauer did, you end up realising that there is a crack in the nature of reality. That the edifice can't hold up if you think about it deeply enough. And Schopenhauer, I think, particularly for me, is staggering in this way. He just, by wonderful reasoning, shows you that your common sense assumptions cannot be true. So, for instance, I believe myself to be in direct relationship to you. I feel myself to be in direct contact with you, just as you feel that in me. But I know that actually you're appearing in the back of my eyes in two different pictures upside down. My brain is then having to put you the right way up and put the two pictures together to make this coherent experience of sight. That must be happening in time, but it's a time that I never have any access to. I feel that I'm in direct contact with you, but I can't possibly be, if you didn't mean, just by the mechanics of my eye. So I can't even rehearse all those shopping and stuff, but you know, that was one example that really stayed with me. And I read it in this particular story, I thought, I remember actually coming to Croydon. I think I was coming from Mitch Convener's meeting many years ago. And I was reading it, and I was so... You end up sort of looking and thinking, so what's happening? You know, what is happening? And I remember as I thought that, I saw this person walking down the platform that the train had stopped. I think it was the recent message. Train had stopped, and this person walked down the platform, and I could see them, and then I couldn't see them. I thought, so what is happening? You know, I just found... I mean, it's difficult to, but if using reason, you can actually see that your reason can't possibly be right. That your common sense assumptions, even things like science, are showing you that they aren't right. So you do not know the place you're in. You do not know, I don't know, the universe that I've taken. I don't know what I am, and I don't know what you are. It's extremely unstabilizing. this is why you need so much positive emotion and so much integration. Because it's not that you commit suicide, it's realise that you haven't got anything to stand on in the first place. It's not that you throw yourself off the Empire State Building, it's that you're already falling. It's me. And you always have been. And then you find that nothing falling, and yet you can't describe it again. But what was striking about McGee's book, which I thought was really quite brilliant, at the end he argues very, very strongly for the limits of reason, and tries to show you how he's shown that. And interestingly he says, traditionally, what you did is you moved on, those who were particularly good at philosophy moved on to religion. Religion originally meant the practical application of philosophy. And it was only those people who were particularly good at philosophy that then moved on to religion. And McGee said, it's a movement I've never been able to make. And he then goes through all the world's religion, and he's particularly rude about Judaism, interestingly. And just says he just can't believe that anybody believes this. And actually when he talks to his Jewish friends, he says, no, they don't. It's just they value the cultural and all the social aspects that go with them. He's very rude about Christianity. Not as rude as Nietzsche, but if you ever read Nietzsche on Christianity, he's extremely rude. He says that you, with the Bible, you need gloves to read it. So infectious and disgusting. It's actually very funny, but... You don't read them to your Christian friends. You know, what interesting he says, of all the religions, the only one that I have any time for would be Buddhism. I don't understand it very much, but that's clearly the only place to go. But what struck me is he couldn't make that move. I thought, actually, for all his wonderful reasoning, he was nevertheless wedded to reason, even though he could see its limitations and demonstrate them with great skill. I thought emotionally he was nevertheless wedded to reason, and so couldn't make the step into and to put it in, but really. So I wrote him and said, you know, I think it'd be really good if you met my teachers and graduated them. And he very kindly wrote back and said, I haven't got time. But I would have loved them to meet. Although I did say that to Bante, oh, I don't think I would have got a word in edgeways. So perhaps just as well. So an intrinsic part of spiritual life is a sense, isn't it, of there being some us partaking in, as being housed within some unknowable mystery, something wondrous, something inexplicable, something that can't be reasoned, something that can't ever be said, some unknowable mystery, some numinous divine, if you see what I mean. Recently I was giving a talk in a church called Where Holiness is to be Found. And of course Buddhism doesn't use the language of holiness, but if you think of the word holiness as denoting something quite beyond the ken of egotism, something quite beyond our everyday mind, and something that feels lit, that feels sacred, that feels luminous, that feels mysterious, then I have no problem with the word holiness. It probably naturally means something to do with the Holy Ghost, so it probably comes directly from Christian theology.
Wholeness?
I don't know, I must look up the etymology. But so I was finding myself arguing for holiness, arguing for the situation we're in, which is utterly mysterious. Now this mysterious nature of our experience, which goes beyond all our capacity to reason, is embodied in the Buddhist tradition by the Buddha. He represents stars, as it were. He represents the numinous, mysterious nature of being. He represents it because he actually become it. When the Buddha becomes a Buddha, he becomes reality itself. He becomes an embodiment of how things really are. It's actually the most mystical, if you see what I mean. Because it's not, but what Bansa says in some ways, that it's not just enlightenment that's mystical. The real mystery is enlightened humanity. Because you've got humanity on one end, streaming up, and you've got the unknown streaming down, and that somehow they coalesce in a person. In a way, that is the greatest mystery, and the Buddha represents that greatest mystery. In a way, it was quite obvious when he was asked, they said to him, you know, someone met him and said, there's something about you, what sort of person are you? Are you a god? And he said, no, I'm not a god. He said, are you a deva, which is basically an angel? And did we ask you that? No. And they asked him, are you an angel? And the Buddha said, no, I'm not an angel. And they asked him, are you a human being? He said, no. So he's saying, I'm something else. You haven't got a category for me. Sangharakshita once said that you could think of the Buddha as a species unto himself, a whole new species unto himself. Something utterly new in the world, something that goes beyond divinity and goes beyond nihilism, that goes beyond this awful debate, this awful argument between religion and science, something that goes beyond both, that includes both and goes beyond both. So spiritual rebirth as a practice means tuning in to that mystical, transcending presence that is all the way, all the time available to us, if our ego could just open up a bit, if we could just be spiritually receptive, if we could just stop going on about ourselves all the time and be open to how things really are. The active dimension of that is actively cultivating devotion. Just devotion, and don't worry about the form at the moment. Just formless devotion, just sit there and find devotion, find love, find adoration for this mysterious business of life, you know. All you need to do is sometimes look out the window and there it is. Yeah. that's especially embodied in the Buddha. Apparently, when Christians went to Thailand, they discovered that there was no word for God in Thailand, and of course that was rather an important word for them. So they tried to find a Thai equivalent, and they ended up with the Buddha who created the universe, because that was the word we had, the Buddha who created the universe. And Sangha actually recently has been saying, well, you could think of the Buddha as a Buddha, as a God that didn't create the universe, that didn't create the universe, yeah. And that our relationship to him could be like that, the God that didn't create the universe, in the sense of, not as a really distinct being out there, but in the sense of the ideal of human life, the ideal of your deepest ideal embodied, and which you can, in a sense, contact by cultivation of your spiritual uplifted imagination. You can contact him. You can speak to him, as it were. I think we need to explore this very, very much more. I think personally I need to explore this much more. I think I've been so keen to get rid of God, I've ended up with just more development in self. And that's a great danger, if you mean, that spiritual life just becomes a greater development in self, which is not a spiritual life. Really, a spiritual life is a commitment to what goes beyond self. That's the whole point. So you can't commit yourself in spiritual life to more of you. You have to commit yourself to something that goes beyond the human. Otherwise, you're just committing yourself to more of you, and that's not a spiritual life, that's just something else. Might be a healthy life, might be a positive life. I think it's eventually self-undoing, self-problematizing, self-defeating. You need to be able to make progress to have a sense that there's something going beyond you entirely, so that you can die. So that when you die, both literally and spiritually, you're not afraid anymore. That there is some animating presence in the universe, which is not subpersonal, but it's not personal. Dante likes to think of it as suprapersonal. It is both intimate to you and both nothing about you. It goes beyond you but doesn't leave you behind. No words talk about these things. The technical word is suprapersonal, which doesn't float my boat, but at least it's philosophically correct. But it perhaps goes beyond you but doesn't leave you behind. I was struck recently by a poem, a great poem by Wallace Stevens called The Man with the Blue Guitar. Beautiful poem, really rather difficult, and by about stanza three I've now lost any sense that I know what earth Wallace Stevens is talking about. Don't start with Wallace Stevens is my advice. Eventually you just think, give me a clue. You know, are we walking down the street? Are we talking to somebody? What are we doing here? Because I have no idea. Anyway, but about the five lines I can understand, there's this lovely one that says, you play upon a blue guitar, you do not say things as they are. And then the character says, things on the blue guitar, things as they are changed upon the blue guitar. I thought I was going to talk about it, I brought it. But this first statement is, you play upon the blue guitar, you do not say things as they are. So in other words, that's saying, you make things up. You play a tune. You make up words and poems and lovely pictures. You do not say things as they are. This is a nihilistic statement. This is Richard Dawkins. This is saying, all that, folks, is just your imagination. You just made some pictures. This isn't what Croydon's like. Go out there and look at it. It's a realist in sports, yeah? Then Stephen says, things as they are changed upon the blue guitar. Yeah. Things as they are. So actually, by imagining, by cultivating the imagination, things as they are changed upon the blue guitar. And interestingly, then they said to him, then play you must, a tune beyond us, yet ourselves, of things exactly as they are. Yeah. So that's an essay, I think, in imagination. It starts with a nihilistic refusal of it. It then goes on to a no, actually imagination changes reality. And then goes on to saying, attune beyond us, yet ourselves. I think that's a brilliant condensation of what I'm trying to say. The Buddha represents attune beyond us, yet ourselves. Depending on where you want to stand in that, it's best to think of it as beyond you. Attune beyond you, yeah? And yet as you get closer to him, you feel it's yet ourselves. Of things exactly as they are. Yeah. Attune beyond us, yet ourselves. Of things exactly as they are. Beyond the end game of nihilism, beyond the false hope of divinity, attune beyond us, yet ourselves. So to do this, we need to consciously reflect on the Buddha, consciously evoke him in our lives, bring him to mind, talk to him, bring him into our consciousness, create an imaginative connection with him. And that can be through reading the stories of the Buddha, that can be talking about him, that can be meditating about him. One of the things I'd like to do this evening is a bit of experiment with it and see whether we can meditate on the Buddha. Or you might just find it like, I can't bring an image to mind, and that's fine. So you just say to yourself, well, what would it be like to be in contact with this figure that was the embodiment of reality? I can't see him, but what would it be like if he was near me just now? Yeah? Or for me, it's my relationship with Bhante and my relationship with people that I look up to. I see in them someone that is close to the Buddha. Sometimes I feel it's almost as if Bhante knows the Buddha. You read seminars about him. He talks about the Buddha like someone that he knows. Oh no, he doesn't mean that there. No, I know he said that, but no, he doesn't mean that. He means this. You know, just like, oh no, I know. Yeah, I know what he can mean. But no, he's not like that. You know. Yeah, no, that's a bit late. Don't bother. He'll just say, yeah, this bit here, I don't think it's very. That's nothing to do with it. What he's saying really is this. It's just like, it's because I know what he's saying, because I know him. He wouldn't say that sort of thing. He's saying this sort of thing. Yeah. And when I have that, I feel closer to the Buddha. My life, and then every time I act ethically, I'm closer to the Buddha, because the 10 precepts, the ethical precepts, describe the Buddha's behaviour. That's what they are. It's metaphysics made practical. The 10 precepts, the ethical precepts, loving kindness and so on, they're just simply saying, this is how the Buddha naturally is. Doesn't try to be, doesn't think, good morning, I'm the Buddha, how can I be kind to you today? The Buddha's compassionate, the Buddha just is himself. And we experience that as being compassionate, yeah? So the 10 precepts are a description of the Buddha. Every time I act more and more fully out of those precepts, I just get a bit closer to him. And I literally do. And I can feel that. And you can feel that. Every time you're generous, every time you go beyond yourself, every time you're a bit patient, you feel yourself closer to something, don't you? You feel yourself closer to some animating force that seems to have a direction to it. Sometimes I've felt this so much that I can feel that I'm being drawn into the force field of something. Sometimes you feel it very, very directly in meditation, particularly. I don't feel that enough, but sometimes I do. So this is all spiritual reasoning. It's not saying there is a God, but it's not saying there isn't. It's not saying there isn't. I can't say anything. It's not saying that life hasn't got some overwhelming meaning or some overwhelming tune beyond us. But there is a tune beyond us, not ourselves, and all we need to do is listen into that tune into it. And we do that primarily by acting ethically and by dying, letting self go, so that we can hear the tune beyond us. Okay, so that's all I've got to say, I think, about spiritual rebirth and about all of these five messages. I haven't been able to talk about spiritual receptivity almost at all. And I haven't talked about the stage of no more effort, or the stage of no more learning, the stage of compassionate activity, spontaneous compassionate activity. I have to leave that for another time. So just before we finish, is there any questions? And see what that is. Slightly, I might have. Whatever.
I can't think of a question. Just at one point in your ramble, you said requesting ordination. You know, this sort of comes up point when you're committing to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth.
Yeah.
And I know that there's people here who have been doing some of the Dharma training course for mitras.
Mm.
And the question is, in probably in some people's mind, about, well, should I become a mitra or should I not become a mitra?
Mm.
Where would you put becoming a mitra within this
scheme? I mean, I'd like to find new ways of talking about all of this, because sometimes when I talk about ordination, it feels like you're just saying effectively, join our club. You know, what's the first part of that advert? I don't remember the advert, join our club. It's really, that's what religions always do, don't they? You know, come in and join us. Oh, don't worry, it's through, and then nice, and then actually come and join our club and sign up and all that sort of thing. Somehow it feels like a sleight of hand, doesn't it? But actually, my own ordination started when I was, I don't know how old, 5 or something, when I sensed, living in little old Henley Garden, that something, I thought there's something of a lie to all this. I remember that strongly, that I thought that everyone is lying, that this isn't it, and that people are lying, either literally or metaphorically, that this is a lie. And I wanted to rage against that. I still do sometimes. I think it's something to be said for a certain kind of rage. There's a lie, but I felt that there must be some meaning to life, and it on gradually, as it were, incoherently trying to follow up that instinct that there must be some more meaning to life, ends up with me saying, and I think this is the best explication of that problem that I've ever found, and yet I need to commit to it, and I always commit to the unknown. So I'm committing to this hunch that there's more meaning to life, and crikey, life is running out. Yeah? With a mitra, I think it's saying there really is something in this. You see what I mean? I'm not committing myself yet. I'm not saying, actually, this is something I'm going to go for. Bhante is very careful not to use the language of commitment for mitra. Even though you becoming a mitra might feel committed, I think sometimes people take it so seriously that when they're asking to be a mitra, effectively they're asking for ordination, but they don't realise it, which is me. Because they think, well, this is me committing myself. It's very, very difficult to know what people are doing when they do something. When they become a mitra, when they ask for ordination, where is it coming from? And sometimes it can seem rather trivial on the top, but actually underneath it's very, very serious indeed. Actually, unfortunately, sometimes the opposite way around. It can seem very serious, but doesn't go very deep. And probably they don't know either, and we don't know. We don't know what motivates us, as I said yesterday. The why and the motivation run off into the dark. So I think becoming a mitra is saying, tell you what, I don't know yet, and I'm not saying this is my life that I'm going to commit myself to, but there's definitely something in this. And there's something in this here, in this tree radical, this order. I don't know what it is yet, but I'm wanting to actually quite consciously explore it more. I've been dropping in, I've been finding out things, and I can drop out. And I think that's very important, that the door opens both ways, that you can come in and you can go. And no one's going to ring you up and say, where were you? I think that's a spiritual principle. It's interesting, I've been leading MBCT courses at the London Buddhist Centre, Mindfulness Based Cognitive Therapy. And you know, in that, you know, because of funding, we're being asked to contact people if they're not there. And what we've ended up with is sending them the handouts and sometimes just ringing them and checking if they're all right. But I still want this principle of, if they don't fancy coming back, that's fine. Yeah? As soon as you start saying how you're getting on, if you're not careful, you move into the world of coercion and manipulation. And there needs to be free access and free egress. If that's the word, you need to be able to go without any compunction. But at a certain point you think, actually, I want to get more involved here, and that's what becoming a mitra is saying. I want to seriously get my head around this. And then there might be a point where you think, tell you what, I've got lots of integration to do, lots of positive emotion to cultivate, but you know, I think this is my life. And not because I'm being told so, but because when I keep coming back, I keep noticing I'm coming back to this, and actually I think, when I look at myself, I'm committing myself to this. So how about I need to make that a public thing, because when I make it public, it becomes more, and because my public life needs to mirror my personal life, because I'm still practicing integration. So I need to look publicly what I am privately. You know, I could still be my old name, but it would no longer really, I'm much more like Maitreya Bandha than I am like the person I was before I was ordained. I'm still a long way short of Maitreya Bandha, but it's more fitting to who I actually am, if you look at me. I need to keep on with that, because I could be Maitreya Bandha, and have got and committed myself to spiritual life and to spiritual death, and then fall all the way back. It's not a achievement, it's just saying that I'm committed to that orientation. And of course, you can, if you don't make effort, you just go backwards stream. And we all do, I do. Long answer.
I'm very struck about this thing which you said you experienced as a child. It's in some resonance for me as well. Mm. And I know it's not the appropriate time to ask you to spend more time on that, but it's something that I would like to hear, because there's a sense that I had when I was a child that everybody was acting and not being themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
And then I had to make a decision to join them.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was quite a crucial decision, I remember making it.
Yeah, that's right.
I feel very unhappy.
Yeah. And that you know, don't you, that you're warping something in yourself to do
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
That you're denying something that possibly might be vitally important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that's a spiritual experience to me. Yeah. I think that is because you sometimes notice that this can't be right. This is, I mean, I remember thinking, these people are lying. They're just lying. You know, I was as well, I'm sure, but you know, I wasn't like a little saint, I can tell you. I'm not like a middle-aged saint now either, but I raged against it partly, and then I somewhere I'd been told that, and all you need to do is more of this, and if you, I thought, well, the picture was, if you can lie like this and kind of act like this, then you can carry, you can do this thing called a life, and I tell you what, it's got in it already. I just said, I can't be that. It's been rubbish, isn't it? But you can't say that, then you can't articulate it even to yourself. All you have as a child is, there's something wrong. I think even things like sometimes, a friend of mine used to have real issues with alcohol. And I think part of it was, tell you what, there's something wrong about this whole thing. So do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to opt out, I'm just going to drink. Because at least that's real, at least that's... I'm not. He told me this experience where he was sitting in the pub, you know, downing pints of beer and watching people coming back from Sainsbury's, you know, with bags of shopping. And he said, "If that's what you're saying," he was saying to me, "you know, if that's what AA was saying, look, we'll get you to such a place that you can come back from Sainsbury's with your shopping. I'll stay in the pub. I tell you what, you see, it doesn't look, it's not great, you know, all these people walking past. You know. But you're saying." Oh no, you need to go lots of suffering and deal with it. So you get to do that. You know what I mean? I think for him it was a desire to destroy the world. And sometimes the desire to destroy the world is because you cannot believe in it. And you're right not to. And that's in your bones right from the very beginning. And that's what spiritual life is trying to draw out. That's what the whole Buddhist tradition is trying to say yes. The Buddhists say yes. You were right then. You were onto something then. He's the only one in the universe that's saying, yes, you're onto something then. Let me guide you from that. Don't dismiss that. And don't be thrown off by real angels over there and real devils over here. There is a path. Yes, that's a literalization of it, and that's a literalization of it. But come this way, you know. It's interesting that one lovely metaphor is that spiritual life is like somebody leading a drunk man home from the pub. Brilliant metaphor. And you're on this slippery path, and there's, you know, a precipice to your left, that's my right, and precipice to my right, precipice to my left. So what you do is you say, okay, left a bit, and then they go left. Oh, no, right a bit, left a bit, left a bit. So I start saying it's a bit like God, and then someone gets that to you, and they go, oh, no, left a bit, and then they get a bit nihilistic. Does it mean? It sounds contradictory, but from the Buddha's point of view, they're just saying, look, I'm just trying to keep you on the path. You know? But they keep saying, I thought you just said right. Now you're saying left, isn't it? It's really confusing. But once you're out of that drunkenness, and that's what human life is, a kind of drunkenness, you can have someone that says left a bit, no, right a bit, right a bit. And you have to trust them. And the only, so that's why you need to cultivate this spiritual rebirth. You need someone, a teacher, a human teacher, and the Buddha himself, who can guide you. And that means taking a risk, because you don't know that they're right, but you darn well know that you're not. Anyone with a bit of sense, and they tell you, I keep falling into ditches. Yeah, I wonder why that happened. It doesn't seem to happen quite a lot, and they seem to be kind of similar ditches. Funny that. I wonder whether there's something else I can do. Anyway, perhaps I've been I'm being hysterical. Thanks very much for coming in. Yeah, I've really much enjoyed it.